When Hurricane Matthew struck the East Coast earlier this month, many people were watching the Federal Emergency Management Agency to see how it would respond. After all, more than 5 years have passed since a storm like that hit the United States. To Deputy FEMA Director Joe Nimick, the agency's performance showed how it's adapted after lessons learned from Katrina and Sandy.
I think that what you see in Matthew is the maturation of FEMA's ability to be prepared and then respond to a disaster like Matthew. You're right. The last big year was 2012, multiple hurricanes, and then obviously what most people recognize was Superstorm Sandy. So since then, we have continued to develop our skill sets. And what I would tell you in Matthew was a very large pre-event placement of people and resources to be able to respond to the needs of the survivors, and that response moved accordingly to how the storm moved. So starting out heavily in Florida and then moving up into the Carolinas as the damage became clearer that South Carolina, but mostly North Carolina, experienced the bulk of the damage.
Because I would think even with good planning like that, you would still have to be kind of agile on your feet, because North Carolina, maybe surprisingly, seemed to get the worst situation relative to Florida and South Carolina.
And I think that's consistent with anything we deal with, is what you expect, particularly with a known event like a hurricane, isn't necessarily what materializes. The potential in Florida was probably more than what we were experiencing in North Carolina had the storm moved 20 more miles to the west than it had the path it was on. Clearly, we all expected that it was going to impact Florida, Georgia, and South Carolina. The inland flooding, which is often the case, if you remember with Hurricane Isabel, Vermont was the most impacted state from Hurricane Isabel back in 2012. So it is often varies based on what the predictions are, because they are just predictions. The ability for us to be mobile and adjust to what is the reality that exists is part of what we have to be able to do to be able to support the citizens that are most impacted by any event.
Now, if you go back to the Katrina days, I think that was when in some sense, FEMA shifted to becoming much more of a first responder than it had traditionally been, because in many ways it was a second responder because it came in with the money after the first responders mitigated the immediate emergency. Has that fully been inculcated at this point?
Well, I think you saw that inculcation play out in Matthew, and yes, I want to remind everyone that FEMA was not able to, by the construct of the Stafford Act, be able to respond or to pre-position resources. We had to wait for the governor to ask. You saw how badly that worked in terms of Katrina. The post-Katrina legislation allows FEMA to expend dollars to be able to move commodities and people forward in anticipation. So the legislation has allowed us to become the responders that we like to think we are now. And we played out pretty well in Matthew.
Now, let's talk about flood insurance for a moment. Certainly, that's playing out in North Carolina, where, as you say, the flooding went inland as far as Route 95, really, in Lumberton and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
There are two pieces of this. There's the process, and then there's the funding. Let's talk about the process for a moment. You have launched a tool for strengthening flood insurance.
So, clearly, we had some big challenges that Hurricane Sandy provided to us. Anything of that magnitude that stresses a system like that really brings out the problems and the challenges you've got. We've worked diligently over the last year and a half to be able to address those challenges, and I think we're in a much better place. This flooding that we had in South Carolina over a year ago has proven that some of the changes we have made, and yet some of the changes we still need to make, are making the flood insurance program more responsive to the customers, the policyholders that are there. It's interesting that you bring out that North Carolina most likely has the impact. Florida has probably more of a higher percentage of flood policy holders, and therefore the money that we are going to pay out may be higher in Florida than it is in North Carolina, merely by those people that actually have policies.
What are some of the specific process changes, though, that were made that will advantage people now trying to get money quickly?
So one of the first things is the ability right away, and our flood insurance program, both in Louisiana and for all the four states impacted here, immediately allowed an initial payment of up to $5,000 before the housing inspector comes. Just knowing you have a policy and you're in the affected area allows you to get some initial money so that you can pay for a hotel or do minor repairs to make your house livable. Then we move in and we've improved the training of the housing inspectors so that they understand what to look for that is unique in a flood environment, so that we put more of them on the ground and put them out earlier so that we get those opportunities for loss to be able to be identified sooner based on the needs of the individual. But at the same time, we extended the period for reporting that loss from 60 days to 120 days. So we give people time to get themselves back to think about what the damage was and ensure that all the damage is being covered. And then we work very closely with the Write Your Owns now to make sure that they are as responsive as can be. And we continue to work down with changes that we will have on how we monitor the Write Your Owns. These are the companies that the individual policyholders have actually bought the policies through. We insure those companies up to the values of the structure itself and then the contents inside those structures.
We're speaking with Joe Nimick, the Deputy Administrator of FEMA. Would it be accurate to say that all of these efforts are aimed at reducing the time between occurrence and making the person at least partially whole? Is the goal here?
Clearly, and I think that's a great statement you made, partially whole. The flood insurance may only be up to $250,000 for the structure itself and $100,000 for the contents, and many of the homes are going to exceed that amount, depending upon the level of damage. The other is, if you don't have flood insurance, the individual assistance program that you may qualify for is far less than anything you'll need to be able to restore your house. Up to $33,000 is the maximum, but it is not everything that you might think is covered. The real issue here is if you live anywhere near a potential flood area, the best program for you to get yourself back on your feet and to get your life back on a reasonable track is to have flood insurance.
And maybe not have upholstered furniture.
People's choices on their furniture is people's choices.
Sure. And what about the funding for flood insurance? That always seems to be a back and forth with Congress.
It is a struggle. I talk about it in terms of microeconomics and macroeconomics. From a macroeconomic standpoint, the flood insurance program is not actuarially sound. It's not unknown that it is about $22 billion in the red. We've borrowed that money from Treasury, and we're slowly trying to pay it back. This year, we'll put a strain on being able to pay anything back between Louisiana and what Matthew has produced, as well as the flooding that we had in Texas around Houston, multiple locations that we have had flood insurance payments go out. The microeconomics is if you make it actuarially sound, what we found after the Biggert Waters legislation was some people are so negatively impacted that they can't afford the insurance and they can't afford to sell the house because of the insurance. How you manage both of those is still a challenge, and we have worked with the National Science Foundation and others to see what is the best recommendations we can make as Congress looks at reauthorizing the National Flood Insurance Program in calendar year or fiscal year 17.
Do you notice the private flood insurance industry expanding to try to meet some of these needs, or are they pretty much in stasis or possibly shrinking?
Well, I think they're not shrinking, but I do think that they are cautiously optimistic that there are products that they will be able to sell. But we also have to guard against the fact that they take the least risky products and leave the federal government with only the highest risk policies, because that would not help make the program more sustaining. The reality of making the program sustaining is getting more people to participate in it. That will lower the cost for everyone. Right now, we do not have a high enough percentage of people actually buying flood insurance, because at every flood event, I hear the same thing. It's been 30 years. It's been 100 years. I never thought my house would flood. We can't give you, based on the climatology and everything else that's going on, to say that any location, if they're anywhere near a river or a stream or the potential, that they may have flooding. We had flooding in 2013 in Colorado that was devastating to Boulder.
And what about fires?
So fires continue to be a major issue that the country is focused on. Obviously, we don't carry fire insurance. We don't subsidize fire insurance. That's pretty much provided just by the private insurance companies. But I will tell you that there is a real challenge in the urban wildfire interface that we as a country have to start understanding. We're building further and further into areas that have high potential for forest fires that are going to cause more and more damage over time. So how we look at that interface and how we decide both from a state perspective and then from the federal government as to how the federal government invests in buildings, how we're going to look at how we minimize the impact by that interface is something that is a challenge we still need to meet.
Because in flood zones, there's often zoning that requires houses to be 18 or 20 feet above the sea level, for example. So you find houses with hollow first floors or maybe a garage, but nothing's living down there.
In the vast majority of those communities that have building standards for floods, it's because they want to take advantage of the community aspect of lowering flood insurance. It is not necessarily individuals that do that on their own. It's usually the community that wants to get a community reduction across all of the community that puts in building standards. And it's the flood insurance program that has actually created more of the communities that are part of those programs that have the building standards than any other program we have.
Because by the same token, people that live in the wooded areas prone to forest fires are often reluctant to clear the brush and make tree breaks because of the interruption in the vistas that they have.
So I'm not going to go into an area that I don't have the expertise in terms of what that urban forest interface should look like. But from a regular Joe citizen on the street, it makes sense that if you're living in an area where forest fires are prevalent, you want to be able to try to get as big a break between you and the fuel as possible.
Let's talk about the idea of supplies and pre-positioning and so forth that happened, again, after Katrina. I guess some of the private sector stepped in with water and so forth. How has that all changed in the 10 years, and what is in place by the government, and how do you use commercial suppliers in post-event situations?
FEMA maintains a baseline of commodities, particularly water, bottled water, meals ready to eat type approach, cots, blankets, basic life-sustaining support in order to be able to support a community for a short period of time until the private sector is able to pick that up. And then often, based on the nature of the disaster, FEMA will be the conduit that buys the private sector commodities and then provides them to the community. We've got a very close relationship through our logistics branch with the private sector to be able to balance that mix of owned commodities with the ability to have contracts in place to provide those commodities. We work with the states, so all of those commodities would be provided on a cost share with the states to make sure that we are providing only what's needed and not exceeding what the requirements would be. We've refined that over many events and provided a substantial amount of those resources in Matthew. We provided over 4.3 million liters of water, 5.9 million meals, about 8,700 blankets. Over 5,000 generators were made available to the states and tribes and local communities. Those generators are not provided full-time. They're restored after the fact. But these are the type of things we keep in place to be able to be as responsive as possible. And those were preloaded into the state of Florida, into the state of Georgia before the storm. And then as we saw the impacts of the storm, they were moved up into South Carolina. And then the vast majority were used, obviously, in North Carolina.
And briefly, what are the transportation resources available for all of this?
So we maintain some trailers. We lease trailers where a lot of these goods are stored, and then we have contracts with haulers, and it's all done through the private sector haulers. So I have contracts that are immediate needs, that they provide the tractors in a very immediate situation, and we can move those things within hours of notification. And in this case, we're able to move them several days before the event actually occurred.
And housing is often a big challenge, too, especially since FEMA is out of the trailer business now. But
we don't like to say trailers. A temporary. We use manufactured housing units, but manufactured housing units are absolutely our last resort because those don't help the community come back as quickly as possible. So in the case of Louisiana or right now in North Carolina, once people are able to, we can identify that they're eligible. They move out of the shelters into temporary sheltering support, which is often a variety of rental. If there are rental properties available, it may be into hotels. And then we look at how the money we've provided can restore their homes. With Louisiana, we're working with a program that the state has asked us to put in place, which is to make, they call it shelter at home, and it's to make the homes at least livable. In other words, damaged drywall is taken out. It is made mold-free. It has climate control so that there is no mold coming up. It has the ability for people to have a refrigerator and a stove until they can either use SBA, with a Small Business Association. The Small Business Association of Louisiana has made over $1 billion in loans already to be able to make the full-time repairs.
And what about the hotels? Because let's go back to Lumberton for a moment, which at 95 has every known hotel chain known to man. Those are inaccessible to FEMA because of the government-mandated rates.
Well, we actually, what we do work with is the local community to be able to, through their Chamber of Commerce, make the hotels and their needs part of the community's restoration. So in Louisiana, while we couldn't get to the government rate, we all settled on a government rate that was a rate that was slightly higher than the government rate to be able to have still 2,400 people that are in temporary sheltering in hotels in Louisiana till we can find more permanent locations for them. We're doing the same thing. So what we find is within the community, we're often able to get to work with the hotels through their chambers of commerce to get a reasonable rate that both the state, because the state is paying part of that, the state and FEMA to be able to put those people up until we can find more permanent responses for them.
We're speaking with Joe Nimick. He is the deputy administrator at FEMA. And I'd like to switch gears for a minute and talk about inside the agency itself a little bit. What do you see as your chief human capital challenges these days? Because this is something that goes across government. And what are some of the strategies for dealing with it?
So we've made our ability to hire one of our largest business priorities. That and our ability to secure and utilize our IT systems. Two of the areas that I probably spend a large portion of my time making sure we are focused on. We've made some big strides on being able to do better recruiting and hiring. My biggest challenge is my reserve workforce. As you might think, that in an organization in 2014 that had fairly few major disasters going into 2016, where I have had extraordinary amount of flooding issues, having a permanent workforce would be a difficult thing because I can't justify it in 2014, but I need it in 2016. So we have a program for intermittent workers that allows people to be part of and trained for FEMA, but they may not be called up unless there's a disaster. We refer to them as our reserve workforce. Fulfilling my reserve workforce is probably my biggest challenge, and we're working very hard on trying to do good recruiting and provide better training for those reserve workforce members so that they are part of our team to be able to respond to any disaster that we may have.
I guess someone could be a firefighter for part of the year and also be a FEMA responder if they're not fighting fires.
The biggest challenge I've got is I don't have a mechanism to allow them to leave their existing job and ensure it's there when they come back, unlike the Department of Defense's reserve program. So the vast majority of the folks I look at already have some sort of an income stream where they don't necessarily need their work at FEMA, or the job that they've got is very comfortable with them leaving for a period of time and then coming back to. So that's one of my big challenges with hiring my reservists is I can't guarantee them work over the period of time that they're a reservist. Unless it's a year like this where my reservists are pretty much, these are dedicated individuals that they may live in Oklahoma and they've been in Louisiana and now they're in Before that, they were in West Virginia, and now they're down in North Carolina. These are true heroes.
What are some of the specific tasks that they actually do?
So an awful lot of them are part of the teams that interact with the individuals, making sure that if they have registered properly, if they have been told that they're not eligible, that they can come in and get an understanding. And maybe they didn't provide the right documentation to be able to get some support, some individual support. We have disaster survivor teams that actually go out to communities and sometimes go door to door to make sure that people know what they're eligible for and that they have applied properly. The biggest challenge we've got, and is for people listening to this, if they're in areas that have been impacted, is the first thing is you have to register for FEMA support. You may not get it, but if you don't register for it, we can't even tell you whether you're eligible or not. So we have an awful lot of people that do that. Now, let's not lose sight. We have focused a lot on the individuals that have been impacted by flooding. We're working with West Virginia now on the flooding that they had back in the spring in terms of schools that may need to be completely rebuilt as the extent of damage. FEMA then goes into the public support or public assistance programs to be able to look at the infrastructure. There will be roads in South Carolina, in North Carolina, that will need to be rebuilt. They'll either, if they're federally maintained, they'll go to the Department of Transportation to get them rebuilt. But if they're state maintained, we will support the state by looking at about 75% of the cost of rebuilding those roads or bridges or schools or emergency management facilities with federal dollars.
And you mentioned registration. What about the idea of registering, say, at tax season time, whether there's any weather on the horizon or not, so that when something could happen, you wouldn't even need to register people on the spot?
Well, you've really gone out into an extreme there. I can't tell you where it's going to be impacted. So basically, you're telling me to have everybody in the state registered. You'd be surprised, because it's not just flooding. It could be a tornado. It could be an earthquake. It could be almost any natural or man-made disaster that impacts. So I think it's more important that we get the word out as soon as possible and as often as possible. If you believe you've been impacted by one of these events that has been made eligible, please register and let us decide with you whether you have a claim or not.
And I wanted to ask you about your 33 years in the Coast Guard and how that has impacted your being able to work at FEMA at this level.
Well, thank you. The Coast Guard was primarily a response organization. I started out my Coast Guard career very early as a commanding officer of a patrol boat that would go out and respond to people in distress. So the core values, the ability to know that you're in a mission that is helping people, whether it's helping them directly through our individual assistance program or whether it's helping them through creating the infrastructure that they rely on in their day-to-day lives, roads, public buildings, that ability to respond and help those in need crosses those boundaries. So my transition from the Coast Guard to being in FEMA was almost seamless.